All right. So let us turn in the Torah to tonight's portion, which is called Shelach. It begins in Numbers chapter 13. And now this one is interesting. Yeah, it's real interesting. We're going to have probably more stuff that we could talk about than I could possibly go through in the time that we have available. So what I'm going to do is, as usual, try to go through most of it anyway. But we won't spend probably as much time on some of the details as I will probably do tomorrow in going back through and hitting some of the stuff in more depth. Anyway, the portion begins, as many of these do, and Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, saying. Well, that part is relatively often repeated in the Scripture. So, of course, the Hebrew name for the portion doesn't take its name from there. You got to wait till we find something that looks a little bit different. And it starts like this then, the quote, Shelach lecha anashim. Send thou is how the King James puts it. Send out men, princes even. Now these are men of renown, kind of sort. I don't necessarily like that term because it tends to imply something else now that I think about it. But anyway, send out some men that they may spy out the land of Canaan. Now, a couple things. First off, that word shelach we've talked about before in a number of places because it means send away or put away or send out. It's a general verb. It's also used for the putting away, for example, to when a man puts away a wife is also shelach. So some people may remember the Hebrew word from there. One of the things, of course, I'd like to do for some of you that are new is the main words, either the words that define the portion or words that we're going to see again or words that might have a different meaning in English than perhaps we would understand from the Hebrew. I'd like to spend a little bit more time talking about the Hebrew, too, because I think there's some real blessing in learning some of that. And that brings me to the next of those words, that they may spy out. Spy out, spy out. Et eretz, the land. They're eretz, right? Or the land. But what's the word for spy out? Well, the root is literally in the Hebrew, it's tur. Tur. So you'll sometimes hear people joke about this. This is one way to remember the word, right? These are spies that are going to go tour the land. They're tourists, if you want. Okay, there's as much of a pun as we're going to do tonight. But in any case, it's a way to help remember that. And interestingly enough, I'll mention this now, try to mention it again at the end. This portion both starts and ends with a reference to spying out, at least in the Hebrew. You do not see it in the English. But I think it kind of helps to really open our eyes if we understand it in the Hebrew. So we'll come back to that later. For now, just kind of set it aside and remember it. There has been a whole lot of midrash about this over the years. You know what happens. We'll go through the first part here. It's going to be 12 men. Again, men that would be princes of their tribes. It lists the names of all of them. Moshe sent them out from the wilderness of Paran according to the commandment of Yahuwah. All of them, men who were heads of the B'nai Israel, the children of Israel. And here were their names. Now, I'm not going to read all the names, but as usual, when you see the names in the Hebrew, it is kind of fun to go through and see what they mean. Like I said, I won't do all of them, but I'll mention a couple anyway. Shamua, son of Zakur. And this name is interesting because Shamua kind of means renowned or awestruck, but it also can mean desolate. So you find in a lot of the Hebrew words, the meaning and its opposite are contained in the word. You have to understand it from context sometime. Or sometimes it's by the way that the word is pronounced, the vowel pointers, but it's got the same root. And I guess the key to my mind is, here are men that were, in fact, all of them described as renowned, and yet the great majority end up being desolate. We know what's going to happen again. They're going to bring a bad report. I won't belabor this because I've talked about it in years past a lot, but at least for those that haven't heard this before, years ago I started thinking about, just what does Scripture have to say about democracy? The great God democracy. Oh, well, let's go through Scripture and let's look and see places where we see what looks like a vote. And how do the majority fare? Matter of fact, we could go one step further. How do literally every place in Scripture where we see people coming and taking a vote or anything that even remotely looks like a vote, how does it fare? Well, we know this one. This turns out to be the first recorded vote, if you will, in all of Scripture. And Joshua and Caleb lost 10-2. It did not work out so well for the spies. So right off the top, when it comes to democracy, we're starting off on kind of a negative foot in Scripture. But let's go through the story. We'll get there in due time. I was talking about the names. We got from the tribe of Shimeon, Shaphat, and some of you remember Shoftim. Well, that's the book that's described as Judges, plural, right? Team is the ending. So Shofet or Shaphat, that word means judge. Of the tribe of Judah, we have Caleb in English. Caleb, as you may remember, is the one fellow who was literally grafted in. He is in the tribe. He leads the tribe of Judah at this point. But Caleb was not a member of the tribe of Judah by birth. He was one of the mixed multitude that came out. And interestingly enough, folks don't know this. We do because we have a puppy dog with this same name. But the word Caleb literally in the Hebrew means dog. And all of that is real fascinating when you see how this fellow who was named literally by or in the name of a dog, then grafted in, became the leader of the tribe of Judah, and acquits himself very well. He becomes one of those only two people to walk into the land. Of the tribe of Issachar, we have Egal, or he... I can't read my own writing. He redeems Egal, son of Joseph. And, of course, of Ephraim, I'll mention this one too, we have Hoshea, son of Nun. Now, wait a second. We're not used to hearing him called Hoshea, son of Nun, are we? Turns out about six verses down, he's gonna get renamed. And this is really, this portion right here in this section, is the only place he ever, this guy that later becomes called Joshua in English, or Yehoshua, it's the only time he's ever called Hoshea. Moshe renames him, and a lot can be made of that. I'll come back to that in just a second, too. We've got other ones. Paul T. Remember when you see a Hebrew word that ends in the E sound, like Paul T, or Gadi? It means something that is personal possession, mine. And in the case of Paul T, it's my deliverance. Then we've got other names, several of them, that end in L. Here's Gadiel, son of Sodi, and of course we know what El is. El is short for Elohim, or in English we would say God, and it turns out that it's God is something, or in this case, El is my fortune, Gadiel. Then we've got, if Gadiel is Elohim is my fortune, then Gadi is just plain old my fortune. Then we have Amiel. Remember, people or nation of. So Amiel is the people or the family of El. Then a couple names right in a row. Sethur, son of Michael of the tribe of Asher. His name means hidden. And then of the tribe of Naphtali, Nabi, whose name also means hidden. Then Geuel, the majesty of El. And I guess I did go through all of them. Anyway, these are the names of the men that Moshe sent to spy out the land. In a way, it's ironic that the only time these fellows, in the case of most of them at least, get mentioned prominently, they do. We do see the names of the tribes mentioned in a few other places, but if there's a place you don't want to be mentioned, I guess it's in this context. These are the names of the men, it says, that Moshe sent to spy out the land. And here we see that Moses calls Hoshea, the son of Nun, Yehoshua. And the rest of the time, we see him referred to by that name, even prior to this. Moshe sent them to spy out, to be tourists in the land of Canaan. He said to them, get you up here into the south, go up into the mountains, go up. Go up. Do you get the drift? A lot has been made of this. When one goes up to the top of a mountain and looks down, people don't look nearly as big. Have you noticed that? I can suggest to you as a pilot that when you're up at about 1,000 feet, people look pretty small. You get much higher than that, you can't see them at all. So maybe if they had done what Moshe asked and gone up first, they would have gotten a view from on high and probably had a better impression. But, well, more about this in a second. See the land, he says. Check it out. What it is, the people that dwell there, and whether they're strong or weak, whether they're few or many, what the land is that they dwell in, whether it's good or bad, what cities they are that they dwell in, whether in camps or in strongholds. Now, at this point, I'm going to pause and kind of head in the direction that I'm intending to spend most of the center part of this midrash on. Clearly, if they had really listened to Moshe and heard his intent as opposed to what it is that they evidently brought back, might have been a little bit different situation. Is it a great land or what? Is that a better way to phrase this? See what this land is, whether they whether it's good or bad, what cities there are, how they dwell. They've already been told that this is a land flowing with milk and honey. This is a promise from Yahuwah, who has basically brought them by a mighty hand out of bondage. They have seen miracles. They have been through the Red Sea. They have heard his voice on Mount Sinai. For crying out loud, they ought to know that if he says it's a good land flowing with milk and honey, that it is. So I'll suggest to you right up front that what Moshe is really saying here is, come on, you leaders, you leaders of the tribes of men, go out and be leaders. Come back in here and fire people up about the mission that we're on. You're going to come back and you're going to tell them exactly what we already know, but as witnesses in this regard. Go up into the mountains, come back, and then let's go do this thing. Whether they're in camps or in strongholds. Now, I have a couple of notes in my margin here. I always like sometimes the little bit of insight that the famous sage Rashi brings, as some of you know, to this. What he says here, if you look at the things Moshe is telling them to do, and you look at what they ended up doing, you begin to see that there's another way that they could have messed up. In other words, things are not necessarily always what they appear. If they live in walled cities, for example, well, we would tend to think, well, that means they're really strong, right? Maybe not. Maybe it's just the opposite of that. If these people were really strong, they wouldn't need walled cities. So perhaps when you judge by appearances, things are really the opposite of what they might otherwise seem. And that's essentially the gist of what he's pointing out. So, let's skip ahead for a second. Oh, there is one other point that I got to mention first. So, see what the land is, whether it's fat or lean, whether there's wood there. And, he says, one of my favorite words in the Hebrew. This is one that we got to learn. Kazak. It's a commandment. It actually appears in this form. Ve-hit chazaktem. Okay? You catch the word in the middle there. What it is, it's conjugated in the plural. Y'all, Kazakh. In other words, all of you, be of good courage. Bring the fruit of the land. Now it says was the time of the first ripe grapes. We know that they had to get two guys to carry these grapes. They went up, they came into Hebron, list the places that they went. And it says here that they came into the valley of Eshcol. And that word, Eshcol in Hebrew, literally means cluster. So they went into the valley of Eshcol. They cut down from there an Eshcol of grapes. They bore it on a pole between two folks, took pomegranates and figs. That place was called the valley of Eshcol because of the Eshcol, which the children of Israel cut down. See, in the Hebrew, it makes a lot more sense. You see why the names mean what they say they mean. They returned from spying out the land, took them 40 days. They went to Moshe and to Aaron, to all the congregation, into the wilderness of Paran. They brought back wood. They showed all of this stuff to the congregation, the fruit of the land, and they told him, and they told them, we came into the land, just like you told us. And you betcha, it sure is flowing with milk and honey, and here it is, the fruit of it. Oh, but you can almost hear it coming, right? But the people that dwell in the land are fierce. The cities are fortified. What was it we just finished saying? And very great. Moreover, we saw the children of Anak there, these big dudes. Amalek dwells in the land of the south. The Hittite, the Jebusite, the Amorite, all these Ite folks dwell in the mountains. Canaanite dwells by the sea. Caleb, basically said, hey, calm down, guys. He turned towards Moshe, and he said to all the people, I like this. I'll do it in my southern fashion. Let's get on down there now. Yeah, we got to go up tonight. Right now, let's just go. He was fired up. Let's go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. But he was essentially voted down. by those other folks. The men that went with him said, no, no, we can't go up there against people, for they are stronger than we. And then verse 32 says, and they spread an evil report. Debat. Evil report. A whispering or a defamation among the land of the land, which they had spied out. And they said, this land through which we have passed to spy out is a land that just plain eats up its inhabitants. All the folks we saw there are men of great stature. Oh, and we saw Nephilim too, sons of Anak, who come out of the Nephilim. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers. So we were in their sight. Now, if you've ever heard about the power of positive thinking and some of those kind of things, too, I don't believe it in that sense, but certainly there are a couple messages here that make sense. I saw a nice teaching by one of the fellows that I enjoy, which is David Foreman, on hopelessness, essentially saying, here you go. You want to see a case study in hopelessness. It's the report of the spies coming back. Oh, woe is me. We cannot possibly do this. We were in our own sight. Wait a minute, if that's how you see yourselves, how the heck do you think they're going to see you, for crying out loud? The bigger issue, of course, is that they demonstrated a severe lack of faith. They have been given promises over and over again that they've seen playing out before their very eyes, cloud by day, fire by night, all of these miracles. And are you telling me they can't believe that if he says they can take the land, they can take the land? All right, here's where we go back and say, clearly, we know, even without me going through chapter 14 and 15, what is going to happen. We'll get there in a second. But at this point, you got to say, what was the problem here? If they sinned, in other words, if they fell short, missed the mark when it comes to the instruction, and clearly they did, because we know what happened, why? Now, there are a number of, as I've said, midrashes, a number of midrashim comments, things that the sages have all speculated about over the years. Probably a lot of truth in all of them. I mentioned the most obvious one already out of sequence, the lack of faith. And it's not just the lack of faith in one another, but clearly it's a lack of faith in the fellow who sent them, in the one who brought them out of the land. Not just Moshe there, what I'm talking about, but of course Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh too. He is the one that has promised them this land. And then we've already mentioned the second one. Rashi pointed this out. They judged by appearances. And it's no coincidence. He suggests, and of course others have said, yeah, he makes a great point here, that this directly follows in the Torah the story of Miriam and her Lashon Hara, where she spoke against Moshe. And she was turned white as snow. She became a metzora, in other words. Some would say, you know, a leper. We've talked about all of that in years past. Moral of the story. They just saw what happened to Miriam, who seems to have judged by appearances and not seen the bigger picture. She was pretty close to Moses, still is. And the spies can't begin to get the pattern. Well, we ought to then. Again, it's about judging by appearances. They judged by appearances. Evidently, Miriam may have done exactly that as well. Now, this next one that I'm leading up to is an interesting one. I don't know that I'm completely on board with it, but it goes something like this. This is attributed, by the way, to a fellow who is called the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, some of you may have heard that name. And he says the problem was that they acted like spies instead of like tourists. That's not his original paraphrase, but I think it's a cute way to put it. They acted like spies instead of like tourists. In other words, and I've already alluded to parts of this too, huh? It's as if their opinion mattered. As if they thought that this was going to change anybody's mind. Well, as it turns out, it did, but it cost them their lives. They were sent there to spy out the land and bring back a report of how, not whether, to do this. In other words, one way to put it, I'll be a little bit blunt here, is lead, damn it, and the people will follow. You guys are supposed to be leaders, do it. But obviously that's not what happened. Now, what he said is this. The Rabbi Schneerson was essentially... You could say making excuses a little bit. He referred to it as kind of a noble way to sin, as if there is such a thing. And said, yeah, the spies were afraid, but maybe they weren't afraid of what we would tend to think about. We too shouldn't necessarily judge by opinions or by appearances. They were afraid, he suggested, as a possibility at least, not of defeat, but of victory. And they were basically making an excuse. In other words, they were playing both hands against the middle, right? The reason that they were telling people wasn't necessarily the reason that was real. Now, I'm not, again, sure if I believe this, but I throw it out because it's interesting, and iron does sharpen iron. And, in fact, we've seen some other things like this that this actually resonates a little bit. If they were afraid of victory, what would they have been afraid of? Well, for one, if they had done what they were supposed to do, which is lead and do like Caleb suggested, let's go on into the land, let's go now, they'd have taken the land and they would have been out of the wilderness in no time. Two shakes. And the manna, the miracle that had come down every day would cease. And they'd be back in the real world. Now, it's a land flowing with milk and honey, but it's still the real world. You guys got to work now. Your shoes might wear out, might have to make new shoes. You're not going to necessarily have a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night like you've gotten used to. That's a little bit scary. You're going to have to go to battle. Even though you know you're going to win, if you'll walk in obedience, you still have to go to battle. You got to plant. You got to do some work. Well, you know what? That is scary to folks that have been living in, shall we say, a Elohim-provided welfare state for a while. So, again, I don't put that down as the main rationale, but I do think it's an interesting thing to point to. And, of course, that brings us back again to this idea of hopelessness. Now, there's one other thing that I want to point out about hopelessness as we move on into chapter 14, and that is that the congregation of Kol Ha'edah, all of Ha'edah, the fellowship, the congregation, lifted up their voice and cried. Now, in the Hebrew, what you find here is that et kolam. It's interesting, the word for all is kol, and this is spelled different, but it's pronounced similar. Their voice is also kol, because it's their voice, it's kolam. They lifted up their voice and cried. That phrase, various scholars have pointed out, appears a number of places in Scripture, identically in the Hebrew, or at least, you know, conjugated appropriately to who we're talking about, singular or plural. The first place we see it prominently is with Hagar. She's been shipped out into the wilderness, and what does she do? Oh, we're fixing to die. She lifts up her voice. She cries out to Yah. Then you have Esau. Remember why he cried? He sold his birthright. Oh, no! He lifts up his voice and cries, Father, have you not got a blessing for me? In both of those cases, what would seem to be the problem here is a little on the negative side. Yaakov, too, eventually. Jacob, he lifts up his voice, evidently, when he first sees Rachel. And he cries because she's beautiful, and he's afraid he's not ever going to have her. I find that interesting. This idea that when people lift up their voice and cry, a lot of times it reflects this attitude of hopelessness. Maybe it's a lack of trust, of faith. All the children of Israel, then, it says, murmured against Moshe and against Aaron. The whole congregation said unto them, we've heard this, and I call this the whining, folks. We've heard this whining before. It's not like it's really new at this point. And by the way, it doesn't seem to be real productive either. Would that we had died in the land of Mitzrayim in Egypt, or we had died in this wilderness. Hey, we're willing to die just about anywhere. Well, don't worry. You're going to die in the wilderness, but hang on, dudes. Wherefore does Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh bring us into this land to fall by the sword? In other words, rather than going into the land of milk and honey, we'd rather just die here now. Our wives, our little ones will be a prey. Were it not better for us to return to Mitzrayim, to Egypt? Now, what we're going to notice in these three verses is we get three references to Mitzrayim or Egypt, too. First time, we should have died there. Second time, wouldn't it be better if we went back to that wonderful slavery? And the third time, yeah, let's do it. So they said to one another, let us make ourselves a captain and we will return. Return, return. Remember that word in the Hebrew? It's shuv, right? Teshuvah. Shuv means to return, turn around. You can return for purposes of good or for evil. Every prophet, as you've heard me say, I don't know how many times, always has that same message. Shuv, teshuva, turn around. You're going the wrong way. And here it is, people going the right way. What do they want to do? They want to shuv right back into bondage. So, Moshe and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation, Kol Edah, of the children of the B'nai Israel. And here comes Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among them that had gone there and gotten outvoted, 10-2. They tore their clothes. They rent their clothes. The congregation of the children of Israel was told by these folks, the land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh delights in us, he'll bring us into this land, and it flows with milk and honey. So do not rebel against Yahuwah, nor fear you, the people of the land. They're bread for us. They're meat for us, literally. We're going to make a lunch out of these dudes. Their defense is removed from over them. Yahuwah is with us. Don't fear them. But the congregation decided they were thinking about stoning them with stones. All of a sudden, here comes the glory of Yahuwah, appeared in the tent of meeting unto all the children of Israel, and he said to the people, through Moshe, said unto Moshe, actually, is what it says here, how long will this people despise me? Let me say that again. How long will this people despise me? And how long will they not believe in me? And I actually think you could strike that word in me there in the English. How long will these people just plain not believe me for all the signs which I've wrought among them? I will smite them with the pestilence and destroy them. I'll make of you, Moshe, a nation greater and mightier than they. Now, this part, too, has gotten a lot of press over the years. Enough's been said about it that I probably won't belabor it too much. But Moshe said unto Yahuwah, and essentially what he does here is, of course, if you're looking for a model for prayer, a model for understanding, what he does, in fact, is repeat back some of the things that he said. In other words, nowadays we would say he quoted Scripture. He counted on the promises of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh himself. And, of course, he uses a little bit of logic, too. When the Egyptians shall hear of this, for you brought them up in your might from among them, won't they say to the inhabitants of this land who have heard that you, Yahuwah, are in the midst of this people, that insomuch as you are seen face to face and your cloud's over them and goes before them, pillar of cloud by day and a fire by night, now if you kill this people, then the nations which have heard of your fame will speak, saying, because Yahuwah was not able to bring his people into the land, which he swore to them, therefore he slain them in the wilderness. So now I pray you, says Moshe, let the power of Yahuwah be great, just as you have spoken. Here he reminds him again, saying, and here again he quotes, Yahuwah is slow to anger, plenty in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. He will by no means clear the guilty. Come back to that one. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children under the third and fourth generation. Pardon, I pray you, he continues, the iniquity, the Torahlessness, the lack of faith of this people, according to the greatness of your loving kindness, and according as you have forgiven this people from Mitzrayim even until now, from Egypt, up until now. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh responds, now listen to this carefully, I have pardoned according to your word. In other words, what this is a partial pardon, if you will. We know they're fixing to die. They're not going to die immediately, but their carcasses indeed will fall in the wilderness. This is, if you will, not only partial forgiveness, but it's an incredible example of mercy tempered with judgment. They don't get away with this. They're literally going to get what they just finished asking for. Would that we had died here in the wilderness. You asked for it, you got it. Not today. But you're not going to see the land because you don't want to. Had you wanted to, you could have gone. Like Caleb said, today, real soon now. But you're going to get, in fact, instead what you have asked for. By the way, just like when they asked for quail, they got it till it came out of their nostrils. Remember that? This very deed as I live, and all the earth shall be filled with the glory of Yahuwah. Surely all those men that have seen my glory, seen my signs, which I wrought in Mitzrayim and in the wilderness, yet here they have put me to the proof, to the test, now these 10 times. They have not hearkened to my voice, So surely they shall not see the land that I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of them that despised me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit within him, probably we'll talk about that tomorrow. It's interesting, because there's a difference, you notice, that Moshe treats Joshua and Caleb a little bit differently in here. And those two men react differently to this position of leadership, too. So there's a lot that could be said about that, probably an hour or more just on that topic. But because it says, in short, Caleb has another spirit within him. He has followed me fully. Him I will bring into the land whereinto he went, and his seed shall possess it. Now, the Amalekite, the Canaanite, dwell in the vale. Tomorrow, you turn, get you into the wilderness by way of the Red Sea. And Yodavah spoke unto Moshe and Aaron, and he said, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation that keep murmuring against me? I've heard the murmurings of these children of Israel. They keep murmuring against me. So say unto them, as I live, says Yodavah, surely, as you have spoken in my ears, so will I do to you. You ask for it again, you got it. Your carcasses will fall in this wilderness, all that were numbered of you. Now we see another reason, of course, why it's important. We've continued to have these censuses taken, these numberings. All of you that were numbered, according to your whole number, from 20 years old and up, you that have murmured against me, you're not going to come into the land, surely, concerning which I lifted up my hand, that I would make you dwell therein. Save Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Yahushua, son of Nun. Your little ones, those you said would be a prey, those I will bring in, and they'll know the land which you have rejected. But as for you, again, your carcasses will fall in the wilderness. Your children shall be wanderers in the wilderness for 40 years because of your strayings, until your carcasses are consumed there. Those number of days that you spied out the land, 40 days, well, you're going to get a year for each one of them. You shall bear your iniquities, even 40 years, and you shall know my displeasure. I, Yahuwah, have spoken. Surely, this I will do to this evil congregation that are gathered together against me in this wilderness. They shall be consumed, and here they shall die. And the men whom Moshe sent out to spy out the land, and whom, when they returned, made the congregation murmur against him. In other words, these are the fellows who now are, going to bear some of the guilt. By bringing up that evil report, that slander, that debah, that defamation, even those men that brought up this evil report, they died by a plague right then and there. Ba-me-gig, a plague before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Joshua, son of Nun, Caleb, son of Jephunneh, remained alive, only of those who went to spy out the land. Moshe told these words to all the children of Israel. Guess what, folks? They weren't happy about it. They mourned greatly. They rose up in the morning, saying, here we are. We'll go up into the place where Yahuwah has promised, for we have sinned. Wherefore, said Moses, now do you transgress the commandment of Yahuwah, seeing it's not necessarily a really good thing to be doing here? So, do not go up. In other words, we're starting to get it, right? Now that we're beginning to see the light, maybe we'll go now. Sorry, guys, it's too late. You had your chance, you blew it. Do not go up, for Yahuwah is not among you, that you be not smitten down before your enemies. How is it that you were so scared of these guys yesterday, and today you're willing to go? Just seeing a few guys die by the plague, and hearing the judgment that's been rendered upon you. Well, there are Amalekites and Canaanites before you. You would fall by the sword, for as much as you're turned back from following Yahuwah, he won't be with you. But they presumed to go up to the top of the mountain. Nevertheless, the Ark of the Covenant of Yahuwah and Moshe did not depart out of the camp. And there came the Amalekite and the Canaanite. They dwelt in the hill country. They came down, and they whacked on them. They smote them, and they beat them down even unto Hormah. Sometimes you got to wonder, are we stubborn, stiff-necked, or what? All right, chapter 15. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to Moshe, and he said, speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, when you are come into the land that I am going to give to you, you'll make an offering by fire unto Yahuwah, a burnt offering or a sacrifice, a fulfillment of a vow clearly uttered, or in a freewill offering, in other words, any of these options, in your appointed seasons, to make a sweet savor unto Yahuwah of the herd or of the flock. Well, he that brings his offering shall present to Yahuwah a meal offering, 10th part of an ephah of fine flour mingled with some oil. and wine for a drink offering, fourth part of a hin. All of this you prepare with the burnt offering or the sacrifice for each lamb. Or for a ram, prepare that meal offering with 2/10 parts of an ephah of fine flour with some oil. For the drink offering, a third part of a hin. So basically, he's given instructions for how it is that you're to make these offerings when you go into the land. When you prepare a bull, it says, for a burnt offering or a sacrifice, in fulfillment of a vow clearly uttered, or for peace offerings, then, you know, do the following. Present that with a different quantity of meal and oil and fine flour and a drink offering of a little bit more wine, an offering made by fire, a sweet savor unto Yahuwah. This is what shall be done for each bull or for each ram or for each of the he lambs or for the kids. And according to the number that you may prepare, this you shall do for everyone according to their number. Now, here's where I think it really gets interesting here. This is something that you can guess if you've heard me talk about the fact that this particular phrase appears in Scripture too. It's one that I will focus in on. All of the homeborn shall do these things in this manner, presenting an offering made by fire of a sweet savor to Yahuwah. All of the homeborn. Okay, well, what if there's a stranger who sojourns among you? Whosoever may be among you throughout your generations, he will offer an offering made by Yahuwah of a sweet savor. So as you do, he shall do. Verse 15, you got it. As for the congregation, there shall be one statute. And let's see here. That word is There it is, chuk, yeah, statute, the chuk. There is one of these for both you and for the stranger that sojourns with you. It is what? It's a statute forever. Throughout your generations, as you are, so shall the stranger be before Yahuwah. Isn't that amazing? Contrast that to America today, where there's one law if you happen to be blessed and anointed of the Elohim that dwelleth in Washington, and for all you peons, the stuff that was guaranteed by what you thought was the supreme law no longer applies. And it's thus throughout much of the rest of the world. One law for you, then the stranger that dwells among you, not when man is the ruler. One law and one ordinance. Oh, he repeats it again as if it was important. One Torah, by the way, is how that says. It literally says, Torah Echat. And not only is Echat one in this case, but it's kind of a unity too. Isn't that interesting? In other words, one instruction. I do think that's a better way to render this than law. One instruction, one ordinance. Ah, there you go. We've got the legal understanding and the bigger picture understanding all wrapped together. Shall be for you and for the stranger that sojourns with you. Verse 17, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, said, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into this land that I'm going to bring you, we're back to that, when you come into the land that I'm going to bring you, then it shall be when you eat the bread of the land, you shall set apart a portion for a gift unto Yahuwah. Then he describes in detail how you're going to do this. The first of your dough you set apart as a cake, which is set apart from the threshing floor, you shall set it apart. Of the first of your dough you shall give to Yahuwah a portion for a gift throughout your generations. Verse 22 says a couple of things that we've kind of seen before too. When, well, actually it says, if you err, if you make a mistake, and you don't observe all these commandments that Yahuwah has spoken unto Moshe, even all that Yahuwah has commanded you by the hand of Moshe, from the day he gave that commandment and onward throughout your generations, it shall be, if this thing is done in error by the congregation and they don't know about it, it's hidden from their eyes, well, then we're going to specify what's to be done. A young bullock for a burnt offering, a sweet savor, and the meal and the drink, all of that, and a he-goat for a sin offering. The priest is to make atonement for all the congregation of the children of Israel, and they shall be forgiven, for it was an error. They've brought their offering made by fire, and their sin offering for their error. The congregation of Israel shall be forgiven. Same thing for the stranger that dwells among them. For in all respect of all people, it was done in error. You notice the difference here. This is a specification of making offerings for things that were done in error. There is a decided difference throughout the Torah when things are done in error as opposed to when they are done in your face in rebellion. The priest shall make atonement for the soul that errs, when he sins through error before Yahuwah to make atonement for him, and he shall be forgiven. And then it tells us again, he that is homeborn among the children of Israel, and he that is a stranger that dwells among them. Oh, yeah, as if this was important. He keeps telling us things that I guess we need to know, repeated over and over again, because, well, it doesn't seem to apply today, right? We're told the Torah is done away with. I could say young bullock and the things that the young bullock leaves behind. No, the Torah has not been done away with. There are supposed to be, at least, if we would ever like to get back into the land, I will suggest an attempt to teshuvah, to return to the things that we should have been doing all along. These were people that weren't in the land yet, and they're still getting the understanding. One law, one Torah, one instruction for you and those that dwell among you, and you're to have one Torah for him that does something in error. But, here comes the but, verse 30, the soul that does something with a high hand, I know it's wrong, piffle, I could care less. Whether he is homeborn or a stranger, that same person has blasphemed Yahuwah. That soul shall be cut off from among his people because he despised the word of Yahuwah. He's broken his commandment. And that is mitzvot, right? The word that means commandment. That soul shall be utterly cut off. He will bear his own iniquity. It shall be upon him. While the children of Israel were in the wilderness, Bamidbar, they found a man gathering sticks upon the Sabbath day. So we're seeing all of this indication here, and immediately what happens is Torah gives us an example. All right? We've just been told about things that are done in error and how there is a procedure, a sacrifice that can be made. The specifications are laid out. When somebody does this in error, they didn't know it, then they're to be forgiven. But here comes a man gathering sticks upon the Sabbath day. One would suspect, I guess it's stronger than suspect, that he ought to know better by now. They found him gathering sticks. They brought him to Moshe and Aaron and under all the congregation. I guess there's a moral here too. All right. Do we still stone people today for doing these things? Well, no, we're not in the land and so forth and so on. We've got all of that. But I guess if I'm looking ahead and saying, since many of us are looking forward to a time of great regathering, and we know that there's going to be some difficulties along the way, and we know that there's things we got to learn, when you begin to see cause and effect, Miriam doesn't get it. Leprous, white as snow, out of the camp. Okay, your brother intercedes for you, good. You get to come back in a week. But hey, if this was her dad that she'd spit on, she's still out for a week. Now, you 12 guys, 10 of whom don't get it and have brought back a bad report. Leaders, you are not. Because of your having convinced people to follow you in this rebellion and not having believed me, they're all going to fall by one by one in the wilderness. Their carcasses will die here. They're going to miss out on one of the best promises ever made to humankind. You folks, though, you 10, you're dead today. You can kind of see the pattern. When there is a complete, clear demonstration on high, when he's right smack in the midst of us, of here are the things that I'm telling you to do and not do, that's not a great time to go literally rubbing his face in it and not doing it. So here's this guy gathering sticks. They put him in a ward. They put him. This is about the only time where you'll see somebody confined, because it had not been declared yet what should be done to him. Yahuwah said unto Moshe, "This man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp." So they brought him outside the camp, stoned him with stones, and he died, as Yahuwah had commanded Moshe. Now, I'm going to point once again. There's no idle word in Scripture. There's also a progression. It's interesting the way in which our Creator has laid out this instruction for us to learn something. So we've just got this discussion of one Torah for you and the stranger that dwells among you, things that are done in error, and then, oops, things that are done with a high hand, regardless of who does it. And here comes the example, and now he is stoned with stones, and he dies. Verse 37, "And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, and bid them that they make throughout their generations fringes on the corners of their garments." What has this got to do with anything? Right? This appears twice in Scripture. It's a commandment, and the word in the Hebrew here is tzitzi. got some hanging on my belt loops. Now, sometimes people will, in a very traditional Jewish or midrashic or rabbinic sense, will say, no, it's got to be done the right way. Well, let me just read it and see what it actually says. It says, Moshe, speak to the children of Israel, the B'nai Israel. By the way, are we the children of Israel? Well, I would hope so. And if we're not born by blood of them, like Caleb, perhaps we can be grafted in. May it be so. In any case, the commandment is the following. Bid them that they make throughout their generations fringes. And that word in the Hebrew there is tzitzit. It's plural. Fringes in the corners of their garments. They put with the fringe of each corner a thread of tekelet. You'll even hear that term used. That's blue. Tekelet. Now, this is where, in rabbinic circles, we got to have the blue, right? Is it the blue? Is it, I don't know. I'm not going to tell you one way or the other. But I'm going to suggest to you that, well, if something kind of looks blue, is it made out of the right kind of snail or not? Maybe if you can get the right kind of snail and you think that's great, more power to you. Go for it. But on the other hand, can you have other colors in your fringes? Doesn't say you can't. Different strokes for different folks. You'll certainly hear teaching say, no, it's got to be tied a certain way, and it's got to have white and one single blue thread. Well, again, what does it say? It says that they put within the fringe of each corner a thread of blue. Now, you could say, okay, that thread is singular. Maybe you can't have two blue threads. I will suggest that probably it's at least one. But hey, your mileage may vary. It shall be unto you for a fringe, for a tzitzit, that you may look upon it, and remember all the commandments, kol mitzvot. There's that word again. All mitzvot of the commandments of Yahuwah. And what? Just think about them and have a get-out-of-hell-free card, I guess. I know. And do them. And do them. Asetem, do. Remember and do. Now, remember how I started this portion out by saying, hey, way back in the beginning, we got this send out men, shalach some dudes out to spy out, to tour the land of Canaan, which I'm getting ready to give to the children of Israel. Tour is the root word there. What does it say here? In English, it says, remember all of the commands and do them. Okay, remember and do, okay, that you do not lo taturu. Recognize the root word? Same root word, tour. So that you do not go after your own heart and after your own eyes, about which you used to go astray. Basically what this saying is, do not go spying after your own heart and your own eyes. It's a clear message to something that we've also just seen. These spies, these tourists, were doing something about like that. It cost them their lives. Those that did likewise, their carcasses fell in the wilderness. We just had a man put to death on the Sabbath because he doesn't get the message. He is rebelling right in the face of a time where you'd think, right, if your dad is whacking kids in your family for doing something, it's not a good time while he's still got the belt in his hand to go out and start doing the exact same thing again. Ha ha! You see me? You know what's going to happen. So what does the whole portion end up with? Let's give you a reminder. Let's give you something that is real physical, that is going to be right on your garment, and that when you see it, and when you... And I can testify, and this is my own little bit of personal stuff. I hang mine, and they tend to get in your pocket, right? They sometimes get in the way. I'll reach in my pocket for my keys, or my pocket knife, or something like that, and I happen to grab a hold of those tzitzit. And I'll pause. Uh-oh, I grabbed that tzitzit. Oh, yeah. Why is that there? For exactly the reason that he says, remember. To remember kol of his mitzvot and do them. So that you don't go spying after your own heart and after your own eyes, which, it says here, you used to go astray. Again, why? So that you remember and do. And by the way, that word remember there is zakor. Remember and do all mitzvoti. Yeah, mitzvot, right? That's that same commandment word again. When it's got the E ending on it, mitzvoti, these are my commandments, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and be set apart unto your Elohim. Now here he signs it. This is almost like the signature line. Ani Yahuwah Elohechem. I am Yahuwah, your Elohim, who brought you out of the land of Mitzrayim to be your El. Ani Yahuwah Elohechem. And that's where the portion ends. So, I didn't ask. I should have up front, I guess. Any questions, comment? Yes, I see the comment on the screen from Kevin. Zitzi and Zitziot. And sometimes you'll see that it ends in a T. It's literally Zitzit as well. In the plural. So, Zitziot and Zitzi. Any other questions, comments? Okay, I won't read all the comments on the screen anyway. Other than to say, again, this is one of those things that... and by the way, it's also pointed out by the sages, and I agree with this too. It says, bid them that they make them. There's another place, the other place, the second witness, if you will, in the scripture where it talks about these, literally says when you wear these zitzit. Make sure you got this blue thread, and it's a reminder. When you wear. It is not necessarily a requirement that you wear them 24/7. Some of the rabbis will say, well, you wear them when you wear a four-cornered garment and so forth. Again, that's not something that I'm going to split hairs over. I think the key part is to understand the why, and that we ought to do it because we need the reminder so that we do not go about spying after our own heart and our own eyes, which he told us we use to go astray. Wear these things, put them on the corners of your garments. I've had some interesting discussions. I get a kick out of this. Actually, it's happened several times in the last few months. A lot of times it's a Christian that will ask, or somebody who comes from a different tradition, what are those things you got hanging on your garment there, or hanging from your belt loops? When it is a person of with a Jewish background, a lot of times it's, those are hanging on your belt loops. You're hanging them on your belt loops. Well, you know, I didn't have a four-cornered garment to wear them, and so I put them on my belt loops. Well, that certainly is interesting. Okay. But, you know, we can differ on the specifics of how it happens, as long as I will suggest we remember that the only requirements here are that they have a thread of blue, and that the purpose is for us to look upon them and remember the commandments so that we can do them.